Hey everybody, welcome back to another week at the Damage Report. I'm John Arola. It's Monday, which means we are graced by the presence of Brooke. How's it going?
Hi, I'm hiding my yogurt. Oh, no.
That's okay. You got in every last second of time before that camera went to you. So other than lingering morning hunger, how are you doing?
I'm great. Sorry, just needed a second there.
You know what? This is an early morning show. She could just eat the yogurt if she wants.
I think that would be a little weird.
Really?
Yeah.
I feel a little bit weird when the camera catches me taking a sip of coffee, but it's like, what do you think the mug's there for? Like, I'm drinking it. It's not fake.
I'm trying to like avoid my lipstick, so it's not for television.
Okay. Okay, so that went about how I expected, and it was not the biggest weekend of news, admittedly.
It felt like it was for you.
Well, no, I mean, there were one or two big events, obviously, that I'm really like hyped to talk about. But sometimes you come back and it's like, there's a thousand things you need to get to.
Yeah.
We don't quite have that, which is nice, because when DC doesn't deluge us with news, it means that we can check in on stories that we don't necessarily always get to. And so as a great example of that, Mitt Romney, I'm kidding. School lunches, the demonization of the poor, the lengths that these school districts are willing to go to make poor people feel the pain is pretty ridiculous. And so we've got a story on that. And as I was producing it, it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And so hopefully we'll have enough time to.
This is the first thing they've done in that area. I know
exactly,
we'll get to
And we're going to touch base with a couple of other areas around the country that are dealing with that issue too. But we've got the big Bernie rally in a little bit. Emma Vigeland, who attended the rally in New York, is going to be joining us. We've got Mick Mulvaney's just amazing defense of the president over the weekend. The latest on what is going on in Syria, Iraq, Turkey, all of that. And so stay tuned, lots to get to, obviously. We're going to be starting off though with AOC. Since last week, we have known, since the debate really, that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez would be endorsing Bernie Sanders. This was, I think it's fair to say, one of the most, I guess, anticipated endorsement. Who will she actually go for? She's one of the rising stars in the Democratic Party. Her endorsement is worth a lot, aside from someone like Obama endorsing someone, and I don't think he's going to do that. Past presidents generally don't. This is about as high profile as it gets. And so she did end up doing that at the Bernie rally this weekend. We've got some quotes from her about how she came to that decision. But first, here is some of her video announcing the endorsement.
This is not just about running for president. This is about creating a mass movement of working class people. The only reason that I thought running for office was even possible for me was because of his example, because he proved that you could run for office and not take big money. And when he talks about a political revolution, and when he talks about not me, us, those aren't slogans. This is not about me. This is not about Senator Sanders. This is about what we have to accomplish together. Our future is not going to get better unless we demand it and unless we work for it. When you talk to Bernie, he doesn't talk about making a movement so that he can get elected. He talks about his campaign as part of a mass movement in America. And that's the kind of leadership that I think we need right now.
There is quite a bit more to that video. You can, of course, find it at her Twitter account at twitter.com/AOC, and we'll have more. I mean, I guess it's not surprising.
It's
We've
not
known
surprising.
It for a
yeah.
week, but it is still big.
It wasn't even surprising, I think. I assumed this was going to happen. I think there was a lot of like a talk that, oh, she's deciding between Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. But I feel like AOC
or maybe
has
not endorsing at all.
Been attached to Bernie.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
So I wasn't surprised by this. It's. I'm sure he's really happy about this. Like someone that he's been working with and supporting, that's still supporting him.
Yeah. I thought there were a few different things that could happen. The biggest individual slice of the pie was she endorses him, but it could be she endorses him after New Hampshire, you know, a month from now, 3 months from now, something like that. That's definitely possible. Lots of people haven't done endorsements yet. I thought that she might support him, but not formally endorse him.
You thought that? You really did?
No. I didn't think that was as likely as endorsing him, but that's certainly a possibility.
Okay.
I mean, she's not just a first term congresswoman, she's in her first year. She's trying to work with multiple people. She has these huge high profile legislative goals that she wants to achieve. And I'm sure, like the Green New Deal, she wants to achieve that regardless of who ends up being president. Obviously, she'd prefer for it to be Bernie Sanders. But if it's not, she wants to have a good relationship with whoever it is. So if her goal is like get the Green New Deal passed, hypothetically, she might not want to endorse just to not shoot herself in the foot. I don't know. That's the wisdom that's floating around.
I'm glad she did though. She did make a decision, just because I think it shows, and kind of bringing in Elizabeth Warren's response to this is like, that's a big endorsement. I'm a supporter of her. And I think after this primary, we'll all be on the same side again. You are allowed to have a favorite presidential nominee candidate in the primary. You're allowed to, that's the fun of it. And people are making it not fun, but it's like, there's so much more of a choice. Like, you're allowed to pick someone and also still support the party, support the larger movement. You are allowed to pick someone.
I agree.
So yeah,
I think that the actual polling places when we go to vote should say that's the fun of it. Get people in there for the fun.
There are a lot of really good candidates, a lot of really good presidential candidates, and I think we're in this space right now where like a couple of candidate supporters angrily are just really frustrated with acknowledging other good candidates.
You're talking about Klobuchar. I'm kidding.
No, but my point is that, and it's not just one candidate's supporters. I think people are getting to this space where they're like angry when you point out someone else or something good about someone else. And there are a handful at least that have really good messages and are willing to fight for something that I think a lot of us like. And so that is fun to me to have a few different people that are, I think, all good candidates that someone for different reasons would pick either one of them as their favorite. And so I think I'm glad, that's what I'm saying. I'm glad that she made this decision because it shows that you can have a favorite and support them, and you should be able to, and that's peaceful. And
I agree. I think that to some extent it's social media perverting things. There are obviously some fan bases that are really vigorously for their candidate, perhaps to the exclusion of everyone else. And I think that unfortunately there are some people in the media who see that and they want those people to support them and give them money. And so they're feeding that sort of resentment and all of that. Yeah. But thankfully, AOC is not one of those people. She's very clear. I mean, even in her tweet about this, she says, in the end, we must come together to defeat Donald Trump. We should do so knowing he's a symptom of a larger problem, and our greatest hope is a multiracial working class movement in the United States of America. By the way, I read late last week that when she actually finally decided and when she contacted Bernie to let him know was when he was laying in the hospital recovering from his heart attack, which I already gave AOC credit for doing this endorsement early on. I know some people think that, well, of course she should have, but it's not that clear cut, I don't think. But the fact that she did it when she couldn't even 100% be sure that he was going to continue his candidacy. I mean, they were probably still doing tests and waiting to see, is he going to be able to continue to do this? And she decided, you know what, I'm not gonna wait until it's safe and endorse then. I'm gonna do it now when he could use a little boost to morale, if nothing else. And so she did that.
But they had been clear that as soon as the first day before they told us that he had a heart attack, the first day when they said it was just stents, they had been clear that he was going to continue his candidacy though.
Yeah.
So
but
she knew he
was admitted to the hospital. They have to say that even if they're not sure, sure. I mean, like obviously it was not the biggest health problem in the world, but they're not gonna be like, oh yeah, this thing might not be over. We'll get back to you in 12 hours. Like they're definitely not gonna say that.
I think I get it. Like it's admirable that she wasn't ageist is essentially what we're getting at.
Yeah.
I guess.
Sort of. That's not the entirety of my point, but yes, a little bit too. I don't think it's really an ageism thing. She's supporting a guy whose candidacy hypothetically might not continue. And also, by the way, he's in third place in the polls right now.
Yeah.
And she's still willing to endorse him. That takes some courage, I think. And there's more. She talks about why she supported him over Elizabeth Warren. You can certainly find that. Uh-huh. And she talks about how important for her personally Bernie Sanders and his example has been. As she said in that video, she would not be involved in this right now if it had not been for Bernie Sanders. And I like to see her supporting him when he's supported her in the past as well.
Yeah, that's kind of how I started that my whole kind of reaction to that is that I think it's good that of course she's sticking with her team.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we talked about Ilhan Omar's endorsement earlier on. Rashida Tlaib is apparently considering it. And so
Rashida Tlaib is not.
I don't think she's
already
done it formally.
She has not. Okay.
I have not seen a formal endorsement.
But the word was that
she was going to, but we'll wait and see if she actually does. Okay, with that, we do have to take a break. On the other side, Emma Vigeland's gonna join us to talk about this weekend's Bernie rally in New York City. We'll see you after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of On the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
This Saturday in New York City, Bernie declared formally that he was back in this thing by having a rally that I hear was pretty well attended, actually. And one of those attendees joins us now, Emma Vigeland of Rebel HQ. Emma, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Great to have you here. So first of all, let me say, I literally could not be more jealous. I considered flying out, but that's just not feasible for me financially. But you got to be there. And so what was your experience like at the rally?
So it was really incredible. No cell service, so I couldn't live text you like I promised. I apologize about that, John. But yeah, there were so many people there. The thing that struck me most is that there were people lining the streets. The maximum capacity for the park that was allocated was 20,000 people, I believe, and there were thousands more who were in the streets, just basically blocking it off, or the police had blocked off a certain portion just so they could hear people speak. I spoke to a very kind couple who loves the Young Turks, who flew out from Phoenix, Arizona, just to see this endorsement, and were so moved by it. So the energy there was absolutely phenomenal. And for me, what strikes me most about this endorsement is how full circle it comes. Obviously, when I was covering now Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, at the start of her race, it was well known that Bernie Sanders was her inspiration for running. When I went to her apartment, there was a Bernie Sanders sign on the front of her door. And I said, wow, I know we're in the right place.
Yeah.
And now she's come full circle and is endorsing him on stage in this really beautiful way, because she's providing him a boost. He was the inspiration for her run. And now when he needs it most, she is giving him the political capital with her endorsement. It's this kind of circle of life thing that's very schmaltzy.
Yeah. So look, you got to be there at this rally, and you've covered a number of different Trump rallies. And so I'm interested in learning a little bit about the different crowds. So based on observation, overhearing, talking to people at this rally, how would you say it breaks out in terms of people who are there because it's Bernie and he's back, and people that are coming because of AOC?
Well, that's really hard to say. I mean, it was a mix of both. She's a total rock star, and there were some people who left after she spoke, but there were also a million speakers leading up to her.
That's true.
So I could sense, you know, I had breakfast and didn't have lunch and was there until 4 and I wanted to die. So I got why people may have wanted to leave. But they are almost this together, this progressive duo that's just kind of, I think, appeals to both all members of the audience. They all wanted to see both of them together. I think really what people came there to see was the moment where she said she's endorsing Bernie Sanders and brings him on stage and they wave and hug. Yeah. It was electric at that moment. That's where everything was firing on all cylinders.
And this would mostly be just a sort of gut reaction, like overhearing people talking. But like you said that the vibe was really strong. Would you say that there was any concern over the way that his campaign is going? Or were these people like as confident as AOC was when she was speaking about Bernie Sanders?
Yeah, I think that in a weird way, the endorsement has reinstilled confidence in a lot of people. So, you know, Bernie Sanders had basically been flatlining at third in the polls and wasn't really going up or down. And the heart attack was seen as, oh, he's got to drop out. I heard that all the time. He's got to drop out. He's got to drop out. He's too old. He can't sustain this. And then just a week later, right after the debate, you get this mega endorsement. The most important endorsement for a Democratic presidential candidate in the race that's possible. Obama's going to wait until the end. That's seen by the establishment press as the most important endorsement. And for a lot of voters, it's very important. Yeah. He's going to wait it out. There was one person who was going to endorse a candidate and actually make a difference. And that person was Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Obviously, the other squad members have a lot of influence too. But she is the front runner and the most important person who could endorse a candidate. And that's why I think people now who maybe wanted to vote for Bernie Sanders but were a little nervous about his chances now feel reinvigorated by this endorsement. And so what she's done by endorsing him at a politically inconvenient time, it has really done wonders for his campaign.
So there was a moment that I tweeted about where he said, like look around and see the people around you that aren't like you. They may not look like you, they may follow a different religion, they may be of a different race, they may be of a different sexuality. But he goes on to say, like, are you willing to stand up and fight for someone else as strong as you would fight for yourself? Mm-hmm. And it seemed like there was a very powerful reaction to that. And so I'm curious, from you on the ground, it's a very different perspective than watching this on Twitch. What were some of the topics that he raised or that AOC raised that got the strongest reaction from the people there?
Well, you know, he did largely what he usually does. So he kind of says the same thing. I've been to a lot of his campaign rallies where he says the same stuff, but that's because he cares about the same stuff. He's very consistent. What I found really powerful was Representative Ocasio-Cortez talking about how this is because of Bernie Sanders. So talking about her struggles as a working class person and how his policy fights have directly impacted her, including discussions of the death of her father, which she does very rarely. Yeah. But having a parent die at 18 years old and then having to be financially responsible for a lot of what's happening in your own family is a huge burden. And she doesn't talk about it a lot publicly, except outside of that documentary that we saw. And I much like Bernie Sanders, who doesn't talk about his personal life very publicly. And talking about that was powerful in a way that it's hard to describe. And the audience reaction was you could feel the emotion in the room. And, you know, it just is a testament to her strength. And I don't know. My reaction really is like, how proud of her would her father be of her? Yeah, that's what I think a lot of people were thinking.
I can say that I certainly was. Emma, as always, thank you for joining us and sharing your perspective from the weekend. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, John.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, updates on Syria, the Kurds, and Turkey, as well as Mick Mulvaney's weekend performance after this.
This withdrawal will take weeks, not days. Until that time, our forces will remain in the towns that are located near the oil fields.
So there you have the Secretary of State talking about the drawing down of troops in Syria. And I know at the beginning of that video, you were probably like, oh God, we don't know exactly what the timeline is. But you probably, like me, felt a lot more comfortable once he had confirmed that we will in fact be protecting the oil fields. Most important thing, really like it to be just the explicit goal of foreign deployments of troops for the US military. That's nice. But anyway, look, we start off with that to sort of get you in the idea of how the news has been going around Syria, Turkey, the Kurds, and what's happening with our troops there. Because I've got like four different bits of news, some of it contradictory about what's actually happening there. But what they all say very loud and clear, regardless of who you talk to, is that the narrative that's been put forth about what is happening and why Donald Trump is doing it is an absolute lie. Anytime this guy has gone forward and said, all I want is an end to our wars, he is spitting in your face. And you're gonna see that as we go through this.
Speaking of narratives, everybody, including Donald Trump, has admitted that this was never a ceasefire.
Yeah, well, we're on the last day of whatever it is. Both sides say that the other side has violated it. It seems like generally the violence has been lower, which from Turkey's point of view, you can afford to have after like a week and a half of just wide-scale massacres of as many people as possible. You sort of bought yourself a little bit of breathing and rearming time. Look, maybe it'll be great, maybe it'll be a great success. The Kurds don't seem thrilled with it, so I'm gonna generally take their side on this since they were the one that was being wiped out in mass numbers. But we'll see. Right. So why don't we go through a little bit of what we've learned over the weekend?
Let's do that.
So US troops leaving Syria will be relocated. Oh, sorry, actually we do have a, actually I'm glad that you brought up the ceasefire because Trump actually tweeted about that this morning. So and he very much echoes what Esper was saying in that video we showed you. He says the ceasefire is holding up very nicely. There are some minor skirmishes that have ended quickly.
So those first two sentences don't go in the same paragraph.
They're a little bit contradictory, yes.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, it could be a relative ceasefire, which is good. The goal should be fewer people being killed.
Right, but that's not the goal of a ceasefire.
It's a less fire, which is not a term that's often used because it's not a term.
Right, it's also not a ceasefire holding up very nicely. It's a ceasefire not holding up at all.
Yes.
But not being as bad as could be.
But in that vein, the beginning of the tweet not as bad as the end of the tweet,
right,
though.
Right,
so
right.
Let's continue. New areas being resettled with Kurds, that's because they're being forced out of the areas they were living in. That's not a plus, that's a negative. They're being forced out of those areas. US soldiers are not in combat or ceasefire zone. We have secured the oil. And to really put like a clinch on it, like the capitalization of oil. And then he says, ending endless wars. So again, that is what he wants you to believe. First of all, he feels the need to be like, yeah, we're protecting the oil. That's usually the part of this that they hide. They're just out and out with it. But then they have this new message, is that they understand that a lot of Americans are sick of these forever wars and want them to be drawn down. My concern is over that very honest, true sentiment being co-opted by hawks who will try to appeal to those people without actually drawing down the wars. And I like when I see the media trying to pretend that this is anything more than rhetoric, it infuriates me to no end because it is the sort of move by the media that is going to allow these wars to continue. And so he says ending endless wars. What's actually happening? Well, US troops leaving Syria will be relocated to Western Iraq where they will continue to conduct operations to prevent a resurgence of the Islamic State. That's according to Mark Esper, or as Trump called him in a tweet before he deleted it and corrected it, Mark, was it Esperanto, which is not his name. It's a language, not a person at all.
It's not a possible typo,
it's weird. I don't know why your phone would autocorrect to that. But the important point is, it is not ending a war if you move the troops east a bit.
Right.
That's not ending a war.
At all.
You can say it's good that they're going there. They'll continue to fight ISIS, maybe they can protect the Kurds. If that's where you're coming from, then fine. But what it is not ending wars. It's just moving them a little bit.
So he's lying.
For the first time, Washington Post, I checked it, it's his first lie. So, but that message, which by the way came from Mark Esperanto, he's not even sure about that. And he doesn't want you to think that he's sure about that, which is why he said things could change between now and whenever we complete the withdrawal, but that's the game plan right now. And he says that not just because you never know what's gonna happen with foreign policy and military conflicts, but because you never know what's going to happen with Donald Trump and how he might change his mind on this. So what's interesting is the defense chief did not rule out the possibility of US forces conducting counterterrorism missions from Iraq into Syria. So not only are they not leaving the region, they're just moving over, but they might in fact continue the same operations in the same place. They're just gonna travel over the border before they do it. So again, like this con is very easy to see through. They're barely pretending. And by the way, in terms of the overall number of troops, they're still gonna leave troops in Syria. Every day they switch back and forth between we're pulling 1,000 out, we're pulling 50 out, we're pulling 1,000 out. We might, in fact, a senior administration official says we might leave 200, likely near the border with Iraq, where they can visit with all the other troops from Syria, which are now in Iraq. And so I just want people to understand that it is great to want an end to the wars and to advocate for it, as like Ro Khanna and Bernie Sanders were and trying to cut our involvement in the war on Yemen. But it can't be a shallow, see-through, fake version of pushing for that, where you pretend that troops being shuffled around the Mideast is doing anything to actually draw down our numbers, while at the same time shipping thousands of new soldiers to Saudi Arabia. Don't get drawn in by this con. There's too much on the line.
I'm with you.
Thank you, I support that. Okay, so there was a little bit more on this, but we are running a little bit low on time. So I'm gonna transition over to Mick Mulvaney, because we had this period where Rudy Giuliani was like the front man for the defense of Donald Trump. That did not work out very well.
And so,
no, not so much. So now we're on to Mick. So let's move to that now. Mick Mulvaney was on with Chris Wallace on Fox News, attempting to explain his comments a few days earlier, where he appeared to confirm that a quid pro quo had happened in regards to Ukraine and the Biden investigation. Here is his new defense.
Not only did you say that investigating the Democrats was one of the three conditions, not two, that you had just said that you had talked about, investigating the Democrats was part of the quid pro quo. You also said, if I may, it was part of the Justice Department investigation into the origins of the Russia probe. But the fact is, not only did the press think you said it, here's what a statement that was put out by a senior Justice Department official. If the White House was withholding aid in regards to the cooperation of any investigation of the Department of Justice, that is news to us. Everybody thinks that that's what you said, and you didn't. You said right there, right. 3 points, not two.
Well, and a couple of different things. You again said just a few seconds ago that I said there was a quid pro quo. Never use that language, because there is not a quid pro quo.
You were asked by Jonathan Carl, is that you've described a quid pro quo, and you said that happens all the time.
And reporters will use their language all the time. So if my language never said quid pro quo. But let's get to the heart of the matter. Go back and look at that list of three things. What was I talking about? Things that it was legitimate for the president to do. Number one, it is legitimate for the president to want to know what's going on with the ongoing investigation into the server. Everybody acknowledges that, at least I think most normal people do. It's completely legitimate to ask about that. Number two, it's legitimate to tie the aid to corruption. It's legitimate to tie the aid to foreign aid from other countries. That's what I was talking about with the three. Can I see how people took that the wrong way? Absolutely. But I never said there was a quid pro quo, because there isn't.
Okay, so that's all cleared up then, pretty much.
I think, okay.
So here's
Chris Wallace tried his best there to point out that, okay, that wasn't your language, but it was said to you like this and you agreed with it.
Yeah.
And he just ignored that.
I think that Chris Wallace is doing a great job of purchasing a ticket to wherever Shep Smith is right now.
Okay.
Being willing to stand against Donald Trump's new champion. But anyway, so he says what he believes happened. Chris Wallace seems to be being fair there. Mulvaney says, no, you twisted my words. You guys are gonna use whatever words you want. So let's play a little game. Let's go back to the transcript and see what actually happened a few days ago. ABC News White House correspondent Jonathan Carl says, so the demand for an investigation into the Democrats was part of the reason that it was ordered to withhold funding to Ukraine. Mick Mulvaney, the look back to what happened in 2016 certainly was part of the thing that he was worried about in corruption with that nation. And that is absolutely appropriate. Carl, but to be clear, what you just described is a quid pro quo. The funding will not flow unless you're getting an investigation into the Democratic server happened as well. Mulvaney, we do that all the time with foreign policy. That was his direct response to Jonathan Carl saying, you're describing a quid pro quo. He says, we do that all the time. Yes. He didn't say quid pro quo there, but he confirmed that it was one.
He agreed with someone who did say that. And his defense is, well, I didn't use the words. I said yes, but I didn't say quid pro quo. I just said yes when someone else did.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, and by the way, he also, Mulvaney, one thing he said there that was inaccurate was the look back to 2016 was part of the concern over corruption. No, it was all of the concern over corruption was his political enemies and investigations he wants into them. He didn't even do 10 minutes of research to come up with other instances of corruption that don't have to do with American politicians so that he could pretend that corruption is the issue rather than his 2020 campaign. Now, the reason Mulvaney should worry about his performance on Chris Wallace is not because Brooke doesn't find it to be convincing or I don't find it to be convincing.
It's a lie.
Well, it is a lie. No, he doesn't have to worry about the truth necessarily. What he does have to worry about is the audience of one that was for, and that is right. Trump. He apparently was not happy with it. President Trump spent the entire weekend holed up at the White House, voraciously consuming media coverage of his White House acting chief of staff and becoming increasingly frustrated by Mick Mulvaney's messy attempts to clean up his quid pro quo admission last week. According to CNN, Trump wasn't thrilled with the performance, including that interview we just showed you. Trump is growing increasingly annoyed that Mulvaney can't seem to properly communicate the White House's impeachment message. It's difficult to, admittedly. Mulvaney, though, does have one supporter out there on these shows, and that is someone who I try not to quote very often, but I like this particular quote, and that is Anthony Scaramucci, who said, Mick Mulvaney was like that teenager in a horror movie that is scratching help me on the fogged shower door, okay? That's what he was doing last Thursday. If I were giving Mick Mulvaney advice, I would resign and get myself a really good lawyer because he's obviously working at the direction of the president. You're going to have to explain a lot of things.
Okay, sure.
I mean, he did get pushed out, so I guess he knows something about that.
He did accept the job.
Yeah, he did. Oh, no.
From a man who was putting babies in cages. It's so it's like, I have nothing for him.
Oh, no, he's a terrible guy. Not disagreeing with you at all there. But anyway, Rudy Giuliani was a bust. Mick Mulvaney is potentially even worse because he both admits to crimes and is kind of uninteresting while doing so. Who's up next? Maybe they'll go back to the vampire kid. What's his face?
Rudy Giuliani under the bus is something that I did not expect at all. I thought, because Rudy Giuliani is a writer and has never made any sense. So
yeah, I think there might be more coming in that area.
Yeah.
Okay, we do have to take a break though. When we come back, Mitt Romney back in the news, but probably not for the reason he hoped.
This is amazing. It's amazing.
So I, like America, have a bit of an issue with Mitt Romney. And it's that he has tried to get this concept that he's one of the senators on the Republican side who's willing to criticize Donald Trump, which is technically true. He has criticized him, but it hasn't really meant much. It hasn't really accomplished much.
It's Jeff Flakey.
It's very Jeff Flakeyan. And the thing is, it's like if you are willing to criticize him in name but not actually do anything to stop his agenda, like what is it actually worth? It seems kind of cowardly. It's cowardice masked with fake strength. But he has found a way to be even more cowardly. And so this is a really fascinating find. I think it was from McKay Coppins of The Atlantic and another reporter who found out that Mitt Romney apparently for some time has had a fake Twitter account or like a burner account or whatever, where he can tweet at people and like things without you knowing that it's Mitt Romney. So this was apparently revealed during a profile for The Atlantic where they asked him about Trump pushing the hashtag impeach Mitt Romney or impeach Romney thing or whatever. And he admitted then that he had this account. And all he said about it was that it had like 700 followers. And a reporter was able to track it down.
It's Ashley Feinberg, right?
Ashley Feinberg, yes.
From Slate. She did like the hard work. Her explanation of it in the Slate piece is hilarious. Mm-hmm. And it's like the perfect, it was like, oh, you're a Twitter creeper? Hold my beer. Yeah. Like it was perfect. And she was able to like just be sneaky and figure it out. Go through all of like his family on Twitter, find the one that has the smallest following and go through every single one of those. I think it was like 400 something followers. Mm-hmm. But it's not just that he was creeping, he was responding.
Oh, I got him.
Oh, okay, they're coming.
I want people to know that work that she did in tracking it down, this is not like, this is our best guess. McKay Coppins, who did the Atlantic profile of Mitt Romney, asked him if Pierre Delecto, which is the name of the Twitter account, was him. And he responded, and I apologize, it's been a while since I took French. c'est moi. So it was, in fact, Mitt Romney, who was Pierre Delecto, which is it supposed to make you think that it's like a really tasty Frenchman? I don't know exactly what that's supposed to mean. So what you should know about this is don't bother going and trying to find this account. It has already been made private, but not before a number of different tweets and likes were screenshotted by Ashley Feinberg and others. So to give an idea of what he was using this for, when Soledad O'Brien shared a story from The Hill about Romney's questioning whether he would endorse Trump in 2020, Soledad O'Brien wrote, "Utter lack of a moral compass." Pierre Delecto responded by saying, "Only Republican to hit Trump on Mueller report, only one to hit Trump on character time and again. So Soledad, you think he's the one without the moral compass? No, he's the brave one hiding behind Pierre Delecto."
Right, this is so wild.
That is Mitt Romney, senator of these United States. But that was not the only one. When Britt Hume from Fox News shared a Daily Caller story about Romney's statement that President Donald Trump's withdrawal from Syria made the US a quote, unreliable ally, along with the comment, "Some might say Romney is too." So that's what Britt Hume said about Romney. Pierre Delecto responded, "Loyal to principle, Trump's loyalty to party or person, right, Britt?" So again, he's talking about the strength of his principles, hiding his identity while doing so.
Right, and you know, so part of me, like when this happened to Kevin Durant, it was funny, but it was easy to be like, listen, he's human. Mm-hmm. And this guy is like putting his body on the line for the game. And of course, like he wants to hit back at people who cannot play basketball a percentage of as well as he can, mm-hmm, and who bag on him. I'm not mad at that. This, you can actively change. Mm-hmm. You can, like, this is not about
your
athletic.
You're implying you could do something?
Right, exactly. It's like, but instead you're like, no, I'm not gonna do anything. I'm just gonna hide behind a fake Twitter account, mm-hmm, and like cheer my bad decisions on.
Yeah, yeah, it's, and especially to hide behind the Pierre Delecto. What was Anthony Weiner's? Was it Carlos Danger? This is Carlos Danger
and
level Twitter
James
activity.
James Comey has had one as well, right?
Oh, I don't remember that one.
This is just,
I don't know.
You guys.
But anyway, there's one. So we implied the issue here. There's one other interaction that he had when one Twitter user, this might have just been a regular person, said, "Congrats, GOP Senate, well done," regarding the fallout from Trump's Syria withdrawal. Romney tweeted, or sorry, Pierre Delecto tweeted, "John, agree on Trump's awful decision, but what could the Senate do to stop it?" I have an idea, literally anything. And that's just not on Syria. You can take that advice and you can run it from issue to issue. You could do literally anything. Hell, tweet from your own account. That's a start.
That's
slightly braver.
That's a big start, right.
Pierre Delecto.
Pierre. The one is absolutely ridiculous. This is so what we should have expected from Mitt Romney.
This sort of cowardice.
It's very like, on brand.
And
the man who has been a politician in two states.
Yeah. Exactly. You don't need to do this. Like, you don't need to defend your. It's really weird and petty to have like this regular alt account that defends you. But then to do weird things like Devin Nunes's cow tweeted at Newt Gingrich saying, "You were cheating on your second wife with the woman who is now your third wife, even while impeaching Clinton for cheating on his wife. Show yourself out." That was Devin Nunes's cow, a parody account tweeting at a former Speaker of the House. And why am I bringing that up? Because Pierre Delecto liked that tweet.
Which, was he talking about Donald Trump or Newt Gingrich?
No, he was talking about Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich and Donald Trump share a few things involving the cheating
right
on their wives.
So like he liked that tweet, but also liked Trump for president. I'm confused.
Well, I think he's implying that infidelity is a bad thing. And he's even said that, like, why do you have this account? You don't need to like a fake digital cow's tweets.
This is so.
Go work, you're a senator.
Romney.
It's so cowardly that he would get, if you want this mantle of bravery, say it out loud, say something. Even that's basically
they
nothing.
They
want to
do
action,
bad things and not be called out for it. That's it.
He wants to be able to write a book or give an interview in 3 years where he says, "Look what I did, mm-hmm, underground, my hidden activity." No. I don't want your Twitter activity to be hidden away. If this is all you're worth to us, you should be hidden away, Mitt Romney. Open up the spot for someone who might actually stand against Donald Trump and his disastrous agenda. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, school lunches and the demonization of the poor across America after this. There is still one group that reliably, if you're in a position of power in this country, you can just attack however you want and probably get away with it. That is the poor in America. Mm-hmm. And so we're profiling another facet of the war on the poor. And this has to do with the Cherry Hill School District in New Jersey. And what happened there was, like in some other areas, the idea of school lunch debt has been a significant issue, a rising issue. Lots of districts, like 75% of school districts in this country had lunch debt over the last year. 40% say the debt is rising. So how are they responding to it? In a humane way? Not so much. Take a look at what they're doing. So the Cherry Hill School District passed a new rule Tuesday night at a school board meeting. Under the policy, students with a negative balance will be able to get a hot meal, but not a la carte items. That's one thing, but they go beyond that and start banning those students from a wide range of different school activities.
And before that, because that seems like it's a good thing, but that is a compromise, because before passing this ordinance that allows them to get a hot meal, they were embarrassing these kids.
Yeah.
With cold tuna.
Exactly. But beyond the tuna even, now in high school, you won't be able to participate in extracurricular activities, purchase tickets for school dances, including literally the prom. You won't be able to attend class trips like senior trip. You won't be able to purchase a yearbook. You can't go to school dances in middle school, also not a yearbook. And even in elementary schools, these kids who they know better, they're holding out. They got the money in their pockets, I bet. They can't go to after school events if they have a balance over $75.
You know what's crazy is this sounds crazy because it is, but this was the rule at my high school.
Really?
In Muskogee, Oklahoma. Yeah, like you couldn't buy a ticket to prom unless you did not have any debt. So that could be a library book, that could be school lunch.
Yeah.
You could not purchase, which is weird.
And it's rational because it's definitely the kid's fault.
Right.
So that makes sense.
The kid's parents can't afford to feed them, and it's like, we have to still let them eat.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. But they're gonna sit here while everyone goes on a field trip.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about the history of this location and a few other places around the country, what's going on. So as you alluded to, back just in August, that same school district came under fire when it proposed giving only tuna sandwiches to students who owed more than $10 and refusing to serve kids at all if they had a balance of more than $20. Let them sit with their aching bellies and think about their financial irresponsibility. It's horrendous, but they thought they could get away with it. But it's even worse than that. It's worse than the current plan. It's worse than the old plan. A retired Philadelphia businessman named Steve Ravitz offered to help Cherry Hill solve its school lunch debt problem, but the school district said it will not accept donations to wipe out the debt. He was gonna pay for it. And they're like, no, you're not responsible for it. The third graders are.
That keeps happening too. Like some rich person will say, hey, this is inhumane, let me take care of it. You're saying your only options are, you know, we can't go into debt. These people aren't paying. The school district needs the money. So fine, let me pay for it. And they all keep saying no.
Well, it doesn't make sense logically. But if this is about demonizing and stigmatizing poverty, it's good at that. I mean, it's literally telling wealthy people your money's no good here. We don't want that. We want them to scrape together $6. Then they can go to prime.
It has to come from them. Like what?
Exactly. And look, you said it's other areas too. I've got one. Around 40 families in a Pennsylvania school district got a threatening letter from an administrator this month. If they failed to pay off their school lunch debt more than $10, they could lose their children.
Right.
Not lose access to food. They could lose their actual children. The letter told parents that sending kids to school without lunch money was a form of neglect and quote, the result may be your child being removed from your home and placed in foster care. That school district turned down $22,000 in donations to clear the debt.
So now
they don't want the money, they want to take your kids.
Right, so now not only does your kid still not have school lunch money, but now your kid needs therapy.
Hypothetically.
We know that with our healthcare system,
our
insurance system, that's probably not covered.
Yeah.
Like this is ridiculous. This is horrible. And I always say the people in charge of children, the children in our communities, the children in this country, the people in charge of their well-being, teachers, school administrators, principals should be better than this.
Yeah. Should be.
This should be,
some areas,
this type of policy should be disqualifying.
Yeah. Well, some areas are taken seriously. Gavin Newsom signed into law a measure that guarantees students will receive state-funded lunches regardless of whether their parents or guardians have unpaid meal fees, which does not mean we're totally out of the woods on this issue there, but at least they will be eating.
Yeah.
And I believe at the weekend rally for Bernie Sanders, AOC brought up the school lunch issue. And I think Ilhan Omar actually has a bill specifically addressing that at the federal level. So there are people on the right side of this.
Yeah.
but it's taken a while to get there. That's all the time we have. Thank you so much. Great to have you here.
Monday.
Enjoy your yogurt. Okay,
thank
you. Oh, it is okay. Well, enjoy your second yogurt. Everybody, thank you for watching. It's been great to have you here. We got big things planned for this week, and so look forward to that. If you haven't already reviewed and rated the podcast, please do that on iTunes. We really appreciate it, and we'll see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.